should we diversify our skill sets? Should we be a modeler, or should we be a textual artist, or should we be a generalist?
Generalist.
A good artist is to be able to be technologically savvy. How do they use the tools to present their
art? In addition to those creative skills.
100%. Right. 100%.
Right. Because of innovations like OpenUSD and the way NVIDIA Omniverse implements OpenUSD so that it can connect multiple 3D production tools, it makes the barriers to entry much, much lower.
You know, so ask yourself as an artist, what is it you do that you want to be able to do in Unreal? The team at Scan was like, it wasn't so much like what we can give you for your budget, it was more like what we can do for your work, and then we'll try and make it work for your budget. Well, did you get the checklist as well? But yeah, I saw the checklist. I'm like, someone spent time, like a human being looked at my machine and quality control checked it for me.
Yeah.
So they didn't get hired specifically because they were a great 3D modeler. That helped, because that was part of the vacancy that was advertised. But it's because they were able to get it into a real-time environment. They're like, wow, now we definitely need you because we're doing virtual production shoots.
Welcome to Beyond the Frames, the media and entertainment podcast that looks at the art, production, and business of creating entertainment. I'm here at Vertex 24 with Haz Dalul.
Hey, I'm back. It's been a while, right?
It's been a while.
It's been a few episodes.
Where have you been?
Man, I've been doing this thing called working on projects.
And what?
I know. It's been insane.
But
I've been watching you. You've been soloing perfectly.
Thank you.
So I feel like I'm the guest here today, so it's good.
Well, no, it's just great to have us both back here at Vertex. This is a creative conference in London that is just bursting with amazing talks, life drawing, and live creative workshops, everything from concept art to drawing to painting to CG work. You know, there's somebody there demonstrating live puppeting in the digital space with game engines.
Yeah.
You and I had some talks and you had a panel as well.
Yeah.
It's been jam-packed. We're gonna get into all of that stuff. But to start with, what's your overall impression of Vertex? I've been loving it all day. Well,
I've never been to Vertex. You know, I remember seeing like adverts for it before. But we know what's really cool is isn't just about coming to these really awesome talks and panels and so on. Like, I find it as like, it's like a breeding ground of meeting up with people that you haven't seen for so long. Mm-hmm. Like, I got like, so one guy I bumped into is David Levy. He's the associate art director on the Dune Awakening game that I'm the Cinemax director on. And we, for 2 years, we've been on Slack, on our phones, messaging, exchanging concert art, giving reviews. For the first time, I meet him. And then I'm bumping to all these other people. So, like, for me, this is a great place to catch up with old friends, meet new people, and also there's some great talks. But what's really cool is that it's the whole location spaced out nicely. You don't feel like you're like a canned tuna or something, you know? So you can breathe, you can like chill out and find places and not feel so cluttered like you would get on those bigger conferences.
Yeah, and there's some great breakout spaces for portfolio reviews.
Yeah.
I've seen professionals taking time out to, you know, really give some wonderful feedback and really helpful insights to, you know, people with portfolio students or people earlier in their careers. And being really generous with their time.
Yeah.
And it feels like the kind of creative community that we all talk about wanting, and it's here, here at Vertex. It's great to see that. You know, the networking thing is such an important point. I ran into Andy Hammond, who's like a creative director at Maverick, which is in the games industry, and he does a lot of promotional art and promotional videos for a whole range of games. So it was great connecting with him, and he's someone I've known for many years. He's a really talented cartoonist and artist in his own right, and now he also works in the games biz. And hearing him speak on his panel with other creators from the gaming network that he's part of was really insightful, because quite often when we think of games, we think obviously of the developers, we think about the graphics industry, we think about the console manufacturers and handheld gaming and mobile gaming, and I don't see enough discussion around the promotional, you know, teams, the people who actually get it in front of you and make you make that first emotional connection with the game and want to play it. So it was really great hearing them talk about that. Now, you were on a gaming-related panel too, right?
Yeah, I mean, the panel I was on was like the state of the VFX industry.
Okay.
So it's a very loose panel, but what was really great, we had some great panelists. We had a guy called Dade who'd worked at Turbo Squid and Shutterstock. We had Marty, who is head of production over at Cinesite. And obviously, the lovely guys at Liaison PR for putting it together. It was a very loose conversation, and you don't even know how these panels are going to be, right? You have your talking points, but it can go anyway. And everyone's trying to avoid the word Gen AI because we just didn't want this to take so long. But what was great was people didn't really care so much about the technology. They wanted to know, from a cultural point of view, how do you work in this industry? Because it's changed, right? Like, when we were starting out, like I guess that we didn't have as much things like LinkedIn, right? Like, was today, you can put your portfolio on LinkedIn and get discovered very quickly. And
ArtStation.
ArtStation, exactly. There's Behance as well.
Yeah, CG Hero. Yeah.
And it's much more of a hustle today in a way that doesn't feel cringy. It was back then, it was like, you go for a recruitment agent and you get, you know, you go for an internship and all that. And to be able to hear, like, the audience wanting to know, having that hunger to know, like, how do we get a job today? And what should we learn? Should we diversify our skill sets? Should we be a modeler, or should we be a texture artist, or should we be a generalist? Is being a jack of all trades good? And these are all valid questions. And we're in a world today where technology and tools being accessible, things like Unreal, things like Adobe
Blender,
Blender, even the stuff that NVIDIA are doing, right? And things like, you know, USD and all that, helps someone carve their career much more efficiently than it was back in the day.
Yeah, so what are some of the takeaways from that session? Because those are really important questions at any stage of your career, right? Because you, even if you're an experienced TD or a cinematographer or a modeler, doesn't mean you can't transfer your skills or even expand your skills into other areas. So right now, with the way VFX is, the VFX industry today, what would be your, how would you answer that question? If, you know, somebody comes up to you, what should someone focus on? What is the most valuable thing?
You know, game engines are a big thing at the moment. And I always get people saying, well, you know, I'm not a game developer, I don't use Unreal. I'm like, I've seen people get hired because they're able to take their assets that they've modeled in Blender. So this is a modeling artist, builds beautiful characters. They're not a game developer, but because this person was able to take her model into Unreal and show that you're able to understand that process in terms of, like, you know, rejigging the shaders and everything to make it work in a real-time engine, they got hired. So they didn't get hired specifically because they were a great 3D modeler. That helped, because that was part of the vacancy that was advertised. But it's because they were able to get it into a real-time environment. They're like, wow, now we definitely need you because we're doing virtual production shoots. We can keep you on for pre-production, keep you on for production. So now, like, it helps. Like, you can specialize, but to be able to say, hey, I can get my stuff into certain formats. Even having an understanding of things like what NVIDIA are doing, or things like USD or OpenUSD, like, having an understanding of that, you don't need to know technicalities, but that helps you as an artist. And that's what I think the biggest takeaway we all agreed on the panel was, back in the day, being an artist was having a good creative eye, being good at drawing, or being good creatively, having a good portfolio. I think as the years go by, a good artist is be able to be technologically savvy. How do they use the tools to present their
in
art?
In addition to those creative skills.
100%. Right. 100%.
Right. You know, and I've learned that quite organically. You know, I have always been the story guy, but on the visual side of things, I've been a 2D artist for most of my career. Drawing, graphic design, video editing, and directing live action. It's been not been the 3D production side of things because of how challenging some of the technical barriers were to upskilling in that space.
Right.
But because of innovations like OpenUSD and the way NVIDIA Omniverse implements OpenUSD so that it can connect multiple 3D production tools, it makes the barriers to entry much, much lower. And VR is another thing that's really helped me take my sort of my drawing ability into the third dimension in a very natural way. It feels like a natural extension of drawing. And that's one of the things I chatted about in my talk for the creation of my show. But yeah, I agree with you that being a good creative, coming up with good creative ideas and problem solving as a creative is still super important.
100%.
But you'll be that much more successful and be able to get access to gigs if you're able to realize those with the technical skills that are kind of commonplace now in the industry, right?
100%. Like, I remember someone asking me, like, in the panel when he did the Q&A, like, what tips would you have for learning Unreal Engine 5? I'm like, I'll say the same thing all the time. It's like, don't try to learn the entire software. Like, ask what is it you do as an artist. So if you're a sculptor, yeah, you don't need to learn animation or learn coding or rendering. You just want to be able to sculpt in UE or get your sculpt into UE to be able to see it. You know, so ask yourself as an artist, what is it you do that you want to be able to do in Unreal? So
and, for, and what are you looking to achieve?
And what are you looking to achieve? Exactly. Like, a production designer would not care about a dope sheet on the animation, right? But they want to know how to light an environment and get still images. They don't want a sequence, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's the big thing, is to set yourself some goals and lists, because it's a huge tool.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was walking the sort of the conference area earlier, and there's some awesome vendors and brands exhibiting some of their products. We're talking about real-time engines and graphics to facilitate a creative idea. I couldn't help but notice Scan have a great booth here with 3XS workstations, professional grade workstations of different sizes and to suit different needs. And it reminded me that this idea of knowing what you're looking to achieve and picking the right tools for it, like Unreal Engine, and picking the right area of it, also comes down to the hardware side of things, picking the right hardware. Now, I'm no expert at building PCs. I understand generally how they work. But that's something I go to experts like them for, where I'm like, this is what, you know, I'm trying to create an animated show. It's got a live component and it's got, you know, normal sort of linear
and video.
And
you're wearing the t-shirt for your show.
Yes, Artina's
like
Art Squad.
Like Brandon.
So, you know, these are the things I'm looking to achieve. And I discuss that with them. And then they go off and find the best hardware for it. I don't need to worry about it. Now, was that what it's like with you?
Yeah, well, like when we set out to make our animated film, which comes out next week, Mechs Beyond, I knew that I was going to do a lot of it myself. Being an independently financed movie, you know, being a director on it, you had to be a very hands-on director. I knew I didn't want to spend time updating hardware. I mean, like you, I mean, I would not trust me near a computer.
No.
You know, I'm that guy that don't even ground myself before I open the computer, right? So I'll short circuit stuff.
Yes, we've heard about that before, yeah.
So I needed to go to a place or a team of people and say, this is what I want to achieve. This is my budget as well. Mm-hmm. And what can I get for that? And what was great is, you know, the team at Scan was like, it wasn't so much like what we can give you for your budget. It was more like what we can do for your work. And then we'll try and make it work for your budget, which is a very interesting combination, actually. And it was great because, like, I didn't have to think about the technicalities. They just want to know, are you going to be rendering a lot of frames? How much caching are you going to be using in Unreal? You know, are you going to be doing editorial? Are you going to have multiple applications open? You know, what version of Windows would you like? Mm-hmm. Right down to, like, what sort of graphics card you're going to need.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was so obvious. It was the NVIDIA A6000. Like, obviously. So they had to make sure that the size of the case matches the GPU, because these things are getting big, dude. Those GPUs are getting big. You can put a lot of fans on them,
and
right?
Like the power of the motherboard and all that jazz.
And you don't think of that as a creative. You're like, you need a lot of power. Your motherboard's gonna be able to support that power. Mm. And then you need to be able to, like, if you want to bring in SSD drives, or PCI drives, you know, to put in there,
you
need to have slots.
And the speed of the RAM and all that, which I'm sure it's fascinating, but it's not really my area of interest.
Exactly. And, like, you know, they would benchmark stuff for you, mm-hmm. which was really great. I mean, I remember, like, this was like 2 years ago, they'll send me the benchmark results. They go, okay, we've tested it. I'm like, what, you actually, we tested it. We installed Unreal and we did a benchmark test. I'm like, you guys do that? So for me, it's like, the minute I received the machine, it's like, plug it in, install Unreal and just run
You mean
it.
You didn't feel at all like, what, you've already used my brand new PC?
I'm glad someone used it.
And you've uninstalled. So what does that mean for, like, temporary files and all that?
No.
I want my thing pristine. When I got my workstation, it was the same thing. I had the 3D Mark benchmark.
Yeah, that's it. That's what
and
I
the
had.
Report. It came with a printed report.
Yeah,
all
got
these
that.
Apps. I was like, that's great. Reassuring. Because they tested the RAM and the CPU and the GPU that it all
did. Did you get the checklist as well? I saw the checklist. I'm like, someone spent time, like a human being, looked at my machine and quality control checked it for me.
Yeah.
That felt good, man. That was like a premium service.
Yeah, so that must be the 3XS thing, right?
That is,
the
3XS must be a free,
All right, so, you know, going back to the networking side of things, I caught up with Matt McCartney, who is a really talented creator. He's a really talented writer, very prolific. And because he's got, you're talking about knowing, you know, technical stuff to facilitate your vision, He has a technical background in entertainment companies, and with that knowledge, he's been exec producing some fascinating projects that blend cinematic storytelling with immersive storytelling and the sequential art of comic book storytelling into a sort of a multi-format IP where you can watch the cinematic narrative in video form, but then you can go into the VR experience and be immersed in a multi-dimensional comic book that is also animated, sort of like a motion comic. So he's touching on multiple formats there of storytelling. It was really great chatting to him. In fact, we recorded a 10-minute conversation just here a little earlier, so look out for that episode. So it was something about VR as a production tool continues to linger in the sort of creative community. It's not picking up at the rate that maybe I anticipated a few years ago when I started using VR for sculpting and animatics, but it's still there. It's sort of cementing itself as like a commonplace utility. It's kind of like, you know, you would use a Cintiq to get into the details of modeling, but maybe you use VR to do the main shapes, block in the main shapes, or do your scene layout. That's at least how I use it for my show. A particular session that stuck out to me was Glenn Southern talking about VR tools and sort of puppeting characters and puppeting elements in the world. Do you use spatial tools in the work that you do?
Well, that's interesting because I was that guy that was like, I don't like VR. It's such an effort to put it on and update my Meta account and blah, blah, blah. But recently, we have an office in Belfast. We're working on our next movie there. And in the same shared space, there's a company called Retinize. And what Retinize do is very, very interesting. They use VR, and they have motion capture. And you can go in as a director, pick up your virtual camera, and your performers could be anywhere around the world, by the way. They don't have to be in the same room, right? And they all got mocap suits. And you see them perform on the character. You do your take, you shoot it, you move the lights. And I was like, this is gimmicky. Tried it, took a while to get used to it, but once you're in there, I can see why you love sculpting, because it becomes a workflow. All of a sudden you're like, oh, there's certain things I can do here that I couldn't really do as fast or as efficiently. And I'm starting to see that how, you know, things like location scouting.
Totally.
You know, if I've got a big CG environment and I want to be able to look at it with a lens, a viewfinder, and that's going back to our history of live action.
Yeah.
You know, when you go location scout, you always have your viewfinder, you do your blocking. And that you can do that in VR now. And the latencies are getting much, much better. The resolutions are getting better. And I'm kind of excited all of a sudden now back for VR. I'm like, huh, this isn't just about playing, you know, Beat Saber or something. This is more. This could be a tool set like a Cintiq or a pencil.
Absolutely. And you know, I don't knock it as a gaming platform. Loads of people love playing games in VR and socializing in VR, and that's great. Yeah. It's not something that I'm drawn to. I use it to, as I say, sculpt characters, do scene layouts. But when I am in Unreal Engine and I put the VR headset on, like you, I have my performer performing the character, which is driven in Unreal in real time. It's the character being driven with mocap or puppeting tools.
Right.
But I'm there in my VR headset directing the character if the character was the actor.
That's cool.
So it's kind of fun working that way too. And because you're in the engine, you understand how far they are from the props in the scene. So blocking in a live action way, even though it's an animated show, can be really productive and kind of fun. It also lowers the barrier for people who haven't worked in animation before, or even children, because it's a kids show. I have child actors.
Right.
You know, they're not going to be trained in software.
No.
You know, they understand how to move through space, and if they're trained in the theater, which they are, that's the language they understand. So being able to go through that space with them with a VR headset, they totally get it, right? They understand what their character's
doing. There's kind of a feeling though, right? Like you're doing animation or any type of 3D work, when you're looking at a screen, it's one thing, but it is very passive. It is very like, it's this. Whereas I think you're in a 3D space, you're like, you're doing this. You're using much more.
You're walking around it.
It feels kind of like organic, and it feels much more tactile. And again, it just reminds me of what it's like being on a film set, where you have to use your spatial awareness to make decisions. Because when you're on a computer screen, there is a spatial awareness to a certain degree where you're in a 3D environment, but you're not thinking spatial awareness like this.
Yeah.
Right? And there's this sense of tone and feeling, that an emotional, just kind of this emotional feeling you get when you are in VR. And I think it takes a while to get used to, I'm not gonna lie, it took me a while, But I can see where this could, you know, as it gets better, the hardware gets better.
Yeah. You know, my talk wasn't about VR per se. It was about converging artistry,
right,
about how my analog art making skills coexist with digital tools and they inform each other all the time.
Right.
VR featured heavily as a demonstration of how I'm bringing sort of my analog, you know, gesture and craft sensibility to a digital space. And ultimately what it does is it helps me think of my show in a transmedia sense that, you know, if I'm creating in real time with a real time engine, I'm in a position to be able to create a game easier than if I was just thinking about the offline creation process that is typical of animation, where you're just focusing on the video, and then if you want to make a game, you have to recreate the assets or start again from scratch. Same with the VR experience, same with AR. And, you know, the industry refers to that as a transmedia entertainment property, or a trans, I would call it a transmedia production method, I guess. Your talk, coincidentally, talked about that. While I'm talking about a series production for an animated kids show across multiple formats, you were talking about it from Max Beyond, how you created your film, your feature film.
Feature film to console game. And then from there, opened up to the world of Fortnite.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is, I remember on the first slide on my keynote was, you know, you do the career thing, like where you started. And it was like, started in the games industry. Slam the door shut. I'm never going to make movies in a game engine. Who does that? I'm going to work in a proper film studio and I worked in VFX. And then a decade later or something, full circle, I'm using gaming technology. But for us, like we used Unreal Engine to do Max Beyond, mainly because it was the comments I was getting when I was doing, before the pandemic hit, I was prepping for my next live action film. And I was using a very early version of Unreal to do previs, right? So like animated version storyboards for those watching. And I remember showing the previs to executives. They're like, what is that? I go, that's the previs. Don't worry, that's just blocked out. I go, no, we've seen previs. Usually previs are like T-pose guy sliding around. It's very rough and ready, grayscale. You got animation, lighting effects, rendering. I mean, this looks rendered. And I was like, oh, interesting. I remember coming back and like months go by, I'm like, why are people not making movies this way? I mean, it's a no-brainer. And at the time, it was like, oh no, it's a game engine. No, you use Maya Houdini. That's not the way to do it.
Yeah.
And now there are tons of people making them. So from there, I just fell in love with it, dude. The same reason you fell in love with Unreal and stuff that you're doing in Art Squad is the fact that there's this liberation feeling as a director to be able to like try things out.
Yeah.
Try things out without an expense of hiring a resource and stuff.
Yeah.
And once you've got that vision, as we say, in place, you can use that to bring people on.
Yeah.
And that's essentially how we built the team for Max Beyond. But as we were building, like a year goes by, a year and a half goes by, you know, there's certain things we start to realize were on the cutting floor. So many things about the world, the characters, there's only so much you can put in 93 minutes without overbloating it, right? Because, you know, we know the rules of storytelling, pacing, and just the right amount of information.
Uh-huh.
So, and also, it's a movie about a big brother breaking out his little brother out of a medical facility and does it over and over again until they find the right reality, right? It's a multiverse movie. So you see it from one perspective, which is the big brother. And I remember thinking, wouldn't it be cool if we saw it from the perspective of the little kid? What's it like? So we put together a game demo, only because we were already in Unreal. We had spent a year and a half building these assets, doing motion capture, doing voice recording. We took all of that, moved it into an Unreal Engine game project, hired one person that knows how to do game coding. We didn't have to worry about the art. And within a weekend, we had a demo running. And all of a sudden, we're like, ooh, what would it be like? Because we had the demo basically, you control the character and the little kid follows you. And you can trigger the little kid to do certain things. We're like, well, I want to play as a little kid. What if we do a split screen? What if we have co-op? Now one person is the kid, the other one, and you work in like a co-op game, like It Takes Two, right? It's a really well-known co-op game.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we're like, we're building game mechanics that is telling a story, a different perspective to that IP that we would not have got if we were in a linear format.
Right.
And a few months go by, we get signed to Idea Xbox, which is an independent developers program at Xbox. We have Xbox dev kits, and we're like, I guess we're making a game. So now we're ramping up on that, and that game comes out next year, and the movie comes out next week. But even that helped position the movie, right? Because like, you know this as much as me, Rafi, but like it's very competitive. Content is very competitive. Mm. There are tons of studios with bigger budgets, smaller budgets, different markets. So what we did was we positioned the movie that's coming out next week as this is a preview of the world, what you're going to get in the game. Uh-huh. Now, all of a sudden, all the gamers are looking at it and go, well, we're going to watch this movie to prep us for the game that's coming out.
Yeah.
You got a bigger audience base and you got a different marketing strategy. So even moving through different transmedia approaches influences your marketing decisions as well.
Right, right. And that's the transmedia opportunity, isn't it? To be able to tap into completely unrelated platforms.
Yeah.
So that the audience has multiple entry points into your story world. And I've seen this sort of strategy been approached in what I think misses the point, and I've seen people do it really well.
Right.
Your approach, I feel, is really smart and doing it really well because you are creating experiences for each format that makes the most of that format and is only trying to do what that format is, what the audience expects in that
yes.
format, rather than trying to shoehorn something in. In the past, what I've seen transmedia properties fall down is when they've executed like a linear story and they clip it up and try to bring that clip to a TikTok
right.
or bring it to a mobile app or something. And it's kind of like, well, what's the point of this? It doesn't give me, when I go to a platform, the behavior I'm going to adopt on that platform is very specific.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I go there.
Yeah.
And on Instagram, my behavior and what the kind of content I'm looking for is very different to if I'm going to watch a YouTube podcast or go to the cinema or play a game, right? So I love your approach because you are thinking about what matters in each format to a specific audience that hopefully is interested in your story world.
It's all about story though, right? That's the thing we always speak about is story is king, right? And really is the story kind of dictates like what platform you want this on. Like for us, we wanted to tell a story from a different perspective, which is the story of a little kid. And we found the video game Medium was the best way to tell that story as opposed to a sequel to the movie or a spin-off
or webisode or something.
Webisode, exactly. Yeah. One of the things we've always experimented in is the graphic novel world. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing now is we're going back into Unreal Engine scenes, positioning, framing certain things, high resolution screenshot directly from the viewport, and then send that to a graphic novel artist to draw over.
Right, right.
So all of a sudden now, even the graphic novel artist is like, hey, I'm utilizing Unreal, I guess. And I think that's the beauty of technology is finding opportunities. Now, we're not doing it because we're trying to make a cheap graphic novel.
We're like,
the assets are there.
And giving the artists a helping hand. They
exactly.
can still take their drawing
100%.
In it, you know, have their personal flair on there, but at least they have a reference for some of the perspectives, some of the
100%.
The key props and characters from the main experience so that it looks consistent. Do you know, I'm also picking up on as I speak to people in the industry, you know, I was at GTC a few weeks ago San Jose, and a number of interviews that I did with professionals that are up on the Scan AI Solutions YouTube channel. What I'm picking up from these professionals is there's an opportunity that's emerging, especially with OpenUSD and as real-time engines become commonplace in multiple sectors, that skills can be transferred from people working in various industries as they move, move with their CG portfolio, their CG experience. You know, what you said earlier about, yes, have a creative eye and have taste and hone your creative and storytelling skills, but supported with the technical skills. That combination is no longer just limited to one sector.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who work in the digital twin space where for manufacturing and industrial use cases, accuracy really matters. So they create a digital twin of a factory, for example, or a car. Now, for virtual production, we don't need quite that level of accuracy, but for set extensions or creating a virtual set and location scouting that before you actually build the set, it's the same discipline. And now that the technologies, the core technologies are compatible, it's not just about, you know, it once was CAD and then we're over here with Maya. Now it's getting to something that, where cross-pollination can really happen. So I'm really excited about that. I'm getting that buzz here.
Is that the interoperability as well, right? Yeah, that's a big word that's being used a lot these days. Because I remember back in the day, we'll work with an architectural firm and they'll use like Revit, right?
Or IGS Rhino files.
Yeah, Rhino 3D files or CAD. And we're like, And they're like a million trillion polygons, right? Because they're not rendering sequences, right? They're every little like nuts and bolts. And we were spending weeks trying to like remove stuff. Was now with like, you know, with USD and, you know, I think FBX were one of the first to really kind of kick off some kind of standardization, mm-hmm. right? With FBX many, many years ago, they were part of the Alias Wavefront people. But I feel like now we're in a position where, you know, people are not stuck with what software they use to model something. Like for Max Beyond, we had people use Blender, similar 4D. We had Substance. As long as it comes into Unreal and it's a good quality that we can work with,
yeah.
it's great. So now mm-hmm. I'm not limited to just a Maya artist mm-hmm. or just a Cinema 4D artist. My limitation really is how good is their portfolio. Uh-huh. I'm looking at their work. I'm not even looking at what they use because I know a lot of that is like, can go into Unreal now.
Yeah, use whatever you want because it'll come in just fine.
Yeah.
You know, and for our indie production, USD is basically the backbone of our production for a couple of reasons. There are many features in USD that are super compelling, but for us, the first thing is, you know, if I'm painting something in Substance,
right.
I can paint the mesh and it'll instantly update automatically
nice.
In my engine. So I can see not just how it looks in Substance, but how it's going to look in the final shot.
Yeah.
So that means just my iterations are going to be quicker. I can get through many more iterations
nice.
Within the same amount of time. And I don't have to worry about exporting, bringing it back in and realizing the textures aren't mapped on properly because Unreal wants it one way and Substance has another way.
You're doing this all yourself though.
More or less on my own. Now, as soon as I started doing this, I realized that that infrastructure can also facilitate the live show that we've got going for hospitals, where we go nice. Into hospitals and create a live animated show where children who are very sick and isolated yeah. because yeah. of their treatment get to interact with a motion capture character in
That's
a world
amazing.
That can also react to the way that the audience wants. So if a child wants to see something on a canvas or is directing the characters, I'm behind the scenes painting onto the canvas in
wow.
Substance, and it updates live in the scene. So it's not just about cool tech
yeah.
that makes interoperability easier for, you know, a production environment, which is great. It also facilitates the creative concept of the show, that we wanted to create a live show that can be much more dynamic for
yeah.
the audience. So again, as we've
That's
been saying,
so cool.
it's story and character is what leads the process and leads the whole production. And technology is finally at a point where it can really facilitate these visions.
But it's interesting your project though, because your project is very much, it's kind of like audience driven in a way, like the live
yeah. portion of it, yeah.
So the kids are kind of like the content creators in a way,
in
right?
a way, they're directing it and participants.
It's freaking
yeah.
amazing. Like if I was a kid, like, you know, that was something I always loved doing. For me, it was Lego.
Uh-huh.
Lego was my thing, but this is a great thing to do. Like, and yeah, no, I think, what's the latency like though? Do you get any lag and stuff, or do you...
the latency of the painting doesn't matter because it depends on the connection. If we're connecting remotely to the hospital,
right.
you're kind of beholden to the internet connection
right.
if you're doing it remotely. But we work out a rhythm of what the latency is, and it's kind of like a magic trick. So, you know, everyone say the words, abracadabra, whatever it is, and let's come up with a magic word, and the children come up with the magic words, and we use that as a chant,
yeah.
and then that buys into like the latency, right? So
wow.
buys you time to afford the latency. But the motion capture, there's no latency.
What
really
are you using for motion
capture?
There.
We've been using the perception neuron suit, yeah. Yeah.
I just ordered mine last
Have
week.
You?
I finally did it.
Excellent.
I got the whole gloves and everything. And the reason I did that is because as a filmmaker, I want to try stuff out.
Uh-huh.
I don't have to like book a mocap studio I love XSense, but XSense also is a suit. What I love about Perception Neuron is they're just trackers you put
yeah.
on. You don't have to worry
no
about the whole
cameras
suit.
To track
exactly,
either.
Exactly. And yeah. you got five finger tracking.
Yeah.
And it's affordable and
yeah.
it comes in a travel case. So
yeah.
for me now, I can travel around and meet actors, or like we're working with a parkour actor at the moment, a guy called Liam in Belfast. And I can just go to where he does his training,
mm-hmm.
put on the markers and get some mocap done.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant.
It's brilliant. And the system is such that if you don't need finger tracking, you don't have to have that on
yeah.
so that you don't have to bring those along
That's
with
right.
you. Just do the body tracking. Well, Haz, we could talk
shop
all day, but here at Vertex, it's been an inspiring time. You know, one of the the last talks that I got to check out was Dylan Sisson's talk on his work on VFX, forward-facing technologies, and using VR in his workflow as well. He's like another, you know, veteran of the industry who's been using spatial tools from like the start.
Wow.
And he's an expert at RenderMan because that's the group he's in at Pixar. And he brings together that high quality rendering you expect from RenderMan along with this sort of very artistic sort of expressive VR sculpting work into just very unique visuals. So it was fantastic to see his session as well. Any other standouts for you from Vertex 2024?
Oh, you know what? I think it's just, I just had a great, I've got to catch up with you after a while.
There you go.
Right?
What could be better than that? Catching up here at Vertex 2024. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you like this stuff, do give us a like and subscribe. Leave a comment if you have any questions for us. And see you in the next one.
Bye.